My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very pleased to be here tonight. I was sitting there thinking, when I first came to Sacramento, there was one speaker meeting here. That was on Saturday night, and it was at the Labor Temple for some reason. And it was 1963. A lot of you weren't even born. These kids here weren't even born. None of you were sober. But I thought someday they'll be here. I didn't think I'd be here 40 years later, still flogging the same old story, but well, it was a little different. I was left Los Angeles today and had a very busy day in Los Angeles. I got to the airport about a little over an hour early because that's what they want you to do now, especially Southwest, which is a heartache. But so I was sitting there and I had to go to the washroom, and I was sitting in the washroom minding my own business, doing my thing. And a guy in the next stall said, "Hi there." I thought, he can't be talking to me. But I realized we were the only two guys in there, and pretty soon there was a silence. He said, "What are you doing for fun today?" And I said, "I'm really not doing anything for fun. I'm going away on a trip. I'm going to Sacramento to talk to people." And I really not engaged in a great conversation. There was a pause. He said, "You know, if you met me, we could really have some fun tonight." I said, "I really don't want to meet you. Why don't you just lay off, pal? I got other things to do." Then there was a pause, and then the voice said, "I'll have to call you back. This asshole in the next stall won't shut up." Glad to be here. There's something else I wanted. I shouldn't waste the time, but I got to do it because Bill Wilson in heaven wants me to do this. About 35 or 38 years ago, the San Fernando Valley, there's an old guy named Bill Livingston. And he had a very strong, he had a man of many obsessions, but one of his obsessions was that everyone in AA should remain anonymous, not only at the level of press, radio, and phone, but from each other. And so in the meeting he was at, one of the small little meetings in the middle of the valley, when they read the traditions, he would whisper along with them, say, "Principles before personalities. You hear that?" "Oh, shut up, Bill. I'm not going to shut up. Needs to be said." Well, after a while, three or four young guys who were kind of flaky themselves, I know one of them was, I was his sponsor, they started mocking Bill. So when he had whispered, they'd stood along with him, "Principles before personnel, is that right, Bill?" He said, This went on for a little while. Then some guy came over from the Sylvan Cedros group to talk and heard this and thought of some sort of a spiritual breakthrough and went back to the Sylvan and Cedros group. Pretty soon they were saying, "Principles before personalities." Nobody knows why. You could ask him, "What are you saying that for?" "I don't know." Then there were about 20 years or longer, there was about four hunchback guys. Well, for about 20 or so years, about four meetings in the center of the valley, where they would say, "Principles before personalities," when they read the traditions. Nobody knew why. Nope, just ask them. Nobody knew. It was just kind of funny after a while. It was all right. Kind of, "Where are you going tonight?" "I'm going to go out and speak for the chanters, you know." And then somehow the cork got out of the bottle and the bacteria got in the air. And pretty soon there's more and more meetings here and there where you find a bunch of people saying, "Principles before personalities. What are you saying there?" "I don't know." Yeah. Then they start saying at the end of chapter 5 or something. Now, tonight wasn't a very big join, but I mean, at the end of chapter 5, there were a few voices out there calling, you know,
God could and would have saw it.
Why were you saying that?
I don't know.
And they read the traditions? A bunch more people hopped on it. Nobody knows why. Probably would do it at the end of the promises, too, if they knew what they were. And the irony of it all is the meeting where it started, part of the format now is the secretary specifically asked them not to chant it. But there's still meetings all over, and people say, and I'm just saying that to report to you. I'm not asking, I don't care if you chant. I go to a meeting where there's 1,200 people every Wednesday night, and nobody chants, and there's a dead silence because we want to pay respect to AA. But if you want to chant, that's okay. Now, if you're new tonight, I want to give you a choice. That's all. You don't have to chant. It has nothing to do with if you've been here a long time, 6 months or so, you're probably so set in your ways, there's no way to do anything about it. But if you've been here 6 months or less, maybe there's a chance that you can fight it off. But if you want to chant, you're doing nothing for AA. It's done nowhere else in the world. It's an interruption of the meeting. All it does, you're mocking Bill in the Canoga Park meeting, and he's been dead since 1978. Okay? Now we'll continue. Thank you very much. Like most of you in this room, I spent much of my life feeling troubled and upset and had a lot of problems. And one morning I found myself in a bad situation. I found myself a situation, first of my background and intelligence and experience cannot be in. Two big guys were throwing me out of a skid row mission in downtown Los Angeles in the cold rain. I said, "Then stay out of here, you damn troublemaker." And I tried to explain to him, I'm not a troublemaker. 3 years ago I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the Elsie and Elmer ads for the Borden Company, running that very week in Life and Time and New Yorker, etc. Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood outside of that damn old mission on a cold, rainy morning. And I just felt I had a terrible feeling. I didn't know what the feeling was. I know what it is now because I've seen it in others. But the feeling that some people get, I'm sure some of the people in this room have gotten it, where all of a sudden you find yourself in a situation where there is no friendly direction. There's no place to withdraw to go back to. Nobody seems to care anymore. And it's a terrible feeling because you really are on your own now and there's nothing going for you. And I stood there and I felt so bad. If some old guy went through that morning and said, "You know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they said you were a boy genius. Now you can't even get a job washing dishes. You were in jail in Phoenix recently and got your teeth kicked out, and they're still bleeding, so you can't get a job anyway. Your clothes are torn and dirty. You've lost your clothes. You can't get a job. You're an only child, and your mother up in Wisconsin, she is no longer allowed to accept your phone calls because your stepfather is so tired of watching you call her and play on her emotions to try to get her to go down to her little tiny bank account and send you some more money that's going to make it all right." He said, "Now, you've been going to AA off and on for almost 10 years, and you sit in these meetings and you smirk, if you'd have said this, and you sneer at these idiots, and now you're dying. Why don't you go back to AA one more time and admit you're an alcoholic before you die?" And if someone had said that to me, and if I were in a mood to be honest, I'd had to tell him, "Pal, it isn't the way it looks. I'm not really an alcoholic. I wish I were. I really did. Because I know there's something wrong with me. I know there's something wrong with me since I was a little boy. And I didn't exactly couldn't put my finger on it. But much of my life has been spent with the feelings of I don't seem to fit in very well like other people. And I don't seem to be able to sustain friends very well. I'm very poor in one-to-one relationships a lot. I feel inadequate sometimes. I feel afraid. I feel less than. I resent people for impressing themselves on me. And I feel bad. I have emotions that come and go. And it just seems like there's never any comfort. And I've spent when I was working and quite successful, I spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to try to find out why do I have these damn feelings that are so unique unto me. And he gave me some reasons, you know, that could have been because I ran away from home too soon, or maybe I did this or that. But I had reasons, what I thought probably were the right reasons. But suddenly realized after a lot of money was spent, I now know why I have these feelings, but I still have them. You know, what good is that to know why? You know, it's just the only possible use, maybe late at night in a bar somewhere, some big moose comes over and says, "What the hell's wrong with you?" And then you can tell him. You know. I was not nurtured as a child by my... I read books. I did a lot of things. But the only thing that ever seemed to make me feel better, when I was 15, I was having a terrible time. I was raised in a very, very, kind of a step very, but strict Norwegian Lutheran home up in northern Wisconsin. And very strict, you know, but I didn't know it was strict. It's the major church of the city, and you know, I was raised in this little Norwegian Lutheran church. And when I was catechized and confirmed and learned to sing little songs in Norwegian, and you got the impression after a while, if you broke the commandments, you're probably going to go to hell. If you broke a few of the commandments, you go to hell. And but if you're just a good man, you'd be a good Viking-like person. And I seem to need more fun than other Lutherans somehow. I don't... By the time I was 12, I knew I was probably going to go to hell, or 10 or 11. And then something strange happened. My parents got divorced. Now, if you could imagine this, in this day and age, I'd never heard of a divorce. There'd never been a divorce in our family, in our church, anywhere. And it really staggered me. And I had never had no way to deal with it. I didn't want to cope with it. But I look back and think, what a weird thing. I immediately did handle it the worst possible way it could be handled. Because I was living a kind of very structured life, not getting straight A's in school, and I'd been shoved ahead a year and a half because I was a fast reader, and all of a sudden my parents got divorced, and I immediately began playing them against each other to avoid discipline, to avoid structure. And when my mother would get on my case, I'd run to my father and tell him stories about her. If she'd get on my case, I'd run and tell my mother. If they both got on my case, I'd go to my grandma. And I just fooled them again and again and again and again. By the time I was 15, I'd outsmarted them all. I was flunking out of high school. I was terribly unhappy. I felt rotten. I really was in bad shape. And what saved me, the war started. And I thought, well, I went and saw some movies about the war and John Wayne movies and things like that. And I thought, that's where I should be. So one day I told my mother I want to go to Superior, Wisconsin to visit my aunt. And she packed my little bag and gave me some bus fare. And I was only this high and face full of pimples. And I got a ride to Minneapolis, and I hitchhiked to San Francisco. Had no idea where the hell I was going. Just to San Francisco. I looked at the map of the school library. Didn't seem that far. And I stood outside of Minneapolis. And the car stops. Where are you going, kid? I said, San Francisco. He said, so am I. Hop in. I hopped in. And we went on. And it turned out he was in the Navy going back to his ship. And they're being called back to a ship. And I just can't imagine why he picked me up. I wish I could find that, but he was a saint almost, I guess, because he would listen to me talk and prattle, and he'd drive on. We'd drove for days, and we'd stop, and there were no motels then. There'd be a trailer cart, and get me a bed, and get me up in the morning, buy my food. And I didn't think a thing about it. I just thought, I never hitchhiked before. I thought that's what it is, you know. And I told him I wanted to be in the Marines and get over there and kill Japs. And he said, well, you're a little small, kid. You look kind of weak, but I'll tell you what you do. I'll take you to the Coast Guard office on Market Street. Tell them you want to get in the Merchant Marine. They're really crying for Merchant Marine sailors, because all the good guys go in the Navy. They'll take almost anybody. Go in there, tell them, and write down you're 16 and see what happens. Okay. So I remember that morning he dropped me off in San Francisco, and I went up to the Coast Guard office, and I want to be in the Merchant Marine. Here's the application. I filled it out and I put down 16. Well, you're only 16, kid. We need your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. And They were so desperate, they issued me Seaman's papers right there. No training, no nothing, just here. Sent me to the National Maritime Union on Montgomery Street. Some guy took me down there and they had me sign a waiver for union dues, whatever. I didn't know waivers were or union dues were. Another guy took me to the Embarcadero. Another guy and I to the Embarcadero. Puts on a big ship. 20 minutes later, we're on our way to the South Pacific. And it really was great for about 20 minutes. You know. That's Treasure Island. That's where the World's Fair was last year. Mm-hmm. That's Alcatraz. That's the Golden Gate Bridge. But the damn ship just kept going, and that's the end of the good times. Some big loop coming out and says, "Get to your forecastle." I didn't know what a forecastle was, but it sounded ominous. You know, that's just where the crew sleeps on the ship. He said, "That's your cabin." And I thought that was funny, because in Wisconsin, the cabin has got logs on it. This is just a room. And I went in there, and there were three of the worst type of people that any small Lutheran dumbbell can be with. And these people are called men. What the hell are you supposed to be? I could see there was some tension, so I told them one or two little jokes that I always used to go over good in study hall. Didn't go over good there. Get in your bunk, for Christ's sake. I remember lying in my bunk, and I never had a movement like that ship was moving, and it was hot in there, and I felt so, I really wanted my mother. But I didn't want to say anything and ruin my image. And these guys start talking, and that put the kiss of finality and horror. They'd talk about what they've been doing in San Francisco. They'd been in San Francisco for 3 or 4 days on the ship, and they had been doing some sinful things. They had been doing sinful things. I remember looking at it and thinking, oh my God, they're suddenly real. Of course, they've all got black hair. Those are the Catholics I've heard about. Oh, man. I don't want to give the wrong impression. Even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. These guys were doing it with people. I couldn't believe my ears. I just felt terrible. But as the ship, a couple of days I found a niche on the ship, I fit very well, I became the ship fool, you know. "Hey, kid, get out of the engine room, tell me we need a left-handed wrench." Yeah. "Hey, kid, go up on the bridge, tell the captain we need some elbow grease." And every day they'd sit around after watch, our watch, and they all had whiskey in their sea breaks. They weren't supposed to have it, but they would drink and tell dirty stories. And I'd just lay in my bunk and think, oh, man. Drinking whiskey and talking dirty, just... And one day, a guy turned to me and says, "Well, how about you, Junior? You think you're man enough for a little snort?" And he shoved a bottle in my face. I'd never been close to a bottle of whiskey even. And that all really offended me. I'm dumb and I'm kind of stupid, I guess, but I am basically a good kid, I thought. And I was getting ready to tell him, "You get that bottle out of my face, you big dummy, you big Catholic." I may be small and I'm kind of weak, but I'm a Lutheran, and we Lutherans don't drink history, and you don't talk to people that do. And he didn't get me away. I was just going to lay that on him. And he said, "Well, do you think you're man enough?" And I heard a voice say, "Goddamn right." Turns out I'm a little weak under pressure, too. Is what I am. So I had my first drink and hit my stomach and bounced up and all over this guy's shirt. No, he was, "Get the bottle, wipe the little son of a bitch before he pukes it out." What I remember about that moment is acute public embarrassment. I don't know anything, any feeling to this day that's more painful than public humiliation. Where someone just makes you look like a jerk and you can't do anything about it. I thought later, There's one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it, because they'd have thrown me overboard, but it would have been cute for a moment. Hey, you, lean over.
Yeah.
Take that. Just give one of the old... But every night after watch, I would, when nobody was around, I'd sneak in that guy's sea bag and take a drink of whiskey. And I hated it, and I'd throw it up and have to wipe it up. I just hated it. But I wanted so desperately for those guys to think I was a man. Of course, I know now they wouldn't have ever thought of me as a man. But I did that, and just sick, and day after day, and never just coming into Pearl Harbor finally. I saw that movie Pearl Harbor a few months ago. The love story is kind of weak, but boy, they recreated the Pearl Harbor the way it looked at that at the beginning of the war. That looked perfect. And I remember I was down and below, and there up on deck, and I was down there taking, and it was the day before my 16th birthday, and I took a drink of that crap, and I stayed down. And I couldn't hardly breathe. Oh, Jesus. And all of a sudden, something strange happened. I found myself feeling significantly better. I just felt, and I learned something I did. I learned that whiskey makes you feel better. I mean, I never had much insights. I never had any insights. I was too dumb. I always envy the guys in AA that have insights. I heard a guy a few years ago said, when I held that first drink down, I knew I'd gone into a new garden of experience with many flowers and fruits to be savored. And when I'd partaken of those fruits and those flowers, I left that garden to come to this wonderful program of fellows and girls such as yourself. And I thought, geez, I wish I'd known that. All I knew is, if you don't puke and you can breathe, it makes you feel better. That's what I learned. And I learned to smoke on that ship. Nobody in my family smoked, but they all smoked, so I smoked and puked and smoked and puked. And one day I didn't puke, and I smoked 2 or 3 packs every day for the next 40-some years. I learned to curse a little bit. I learned to lust effectively. None of it ever worked, but I knew what to do. You don't want to go to bed, do you, honey? That never has worked out, that line. And then I got another ship going to the Aleutian. Some of you don't remember this, but in the war, the Japanese, the weekend they fought at Midway, they also sent an expeditionary force and captured part of the Aleutian Islands. So we had to get them out of there later. And when I was 17, we went in the Navy. And the war as the Naval Hospital over in Pleasanton, California, being sewed together. And they passed around some tests. I've always been good on tests. And so I wrote it very well. As a result, they gave me Armed Forces Institute, gave me a high school diploma, because I'm still a beginning junior in high school. I went back to Wisconsin after the war and went to the University of Wisconsin and did quite well, won some trophies with the university, met a girl with, she was so romantic, dark black flashing hair, eyes and black hair, and just ethereal, romantic. Never see anything like that in the Lutheran church, I'll tell you. And she won my heart, and she dropped the big bomb, you know. I'm a Catholic. Can't bring her home. What can I do with her? But she won my heart. I couldn't get out of the net, and we were married, and my grandmother went into a depression for about 2 years. She used to cry when she saw me. But I went out in the world, and I became a newspaper sports writer, which to this day is my favorite job I've ever held. Wrote and covered football and baseball, and I really loved that job, and I really enjoyed it. But then my wife began manifesting the terrible habit patterns of Catholic that I never knew about, but I found out to my dismay. If any of your boys here are Protestants, if you think about this twice when you marry a Catholic girl. Because if she's a good girl, you are about to become the father of a large family. I became a national distributor of small Catholics. Just... Remember saying to my wife, can't we use birth control? She said, no. And I look back, I don't know what I'd have done if she had said yes. Because it's hard for young people to realize. In those days, nobody talked about these things. I mean, I was a senior in college and had been in the Navy and overseas, and I don't suppose I heard the word condom maybe once. And that was in a Navy training film where they showed this voluptuous girl and told you what would happen unless you wore a condom. And she looked so good to me, I didn't care if I caught it or not, if I could just get her. Made me hot is what it did. In those days, what you would see, it's kind of hard to remember now, but some of the older persons here know this. I mean, some kid would come by and say, I got a rubber. And even they would be ashamed to go in and buy them. They'd have to hire somebody really depraved. And even they would be ashamed. They'd go and say, hey, give me some cigarettes.
And some rubbers.
Now look how different it is now. At least in where I live, there's a Rite Aid drugstore. These kids come in about 15 years old, looks like. They're saying things, I want a package of condoms.
And some cigarettes. So
I had to get bigger. I had to get better jobs. I got to find into advertising agencies and public relations firms. I made some more money. And all these years I drank, because I loved to drink, and smoked and cursed and lusted effectively. And the feeling was I acted a little bizarrely when I drank too much. And I, later on, a psychiatrist pointed out why, because I'd been restrained as a child and repressed, and this opened the floodgates. But I tried telling that to a cop, but he never liked it. They said, why don't you go to AA? There's this new thing in town. Some of the old drunks are really cutting down. So I went, and a bunch of old fools sitting around the table, you know, 40s and 50s. I thought I was in God's waiting room, you know. They were saying things like, when I drink, when I get drunk, it's just terrible. But then I get sober, it's just wonderful. I come to AA. Then I get drunk, and it's just terrible. Then I get sober, and I come to AA, and it's wonderful. Then I get drunk, and it's just terrible. I mean, Jesus, you got a problem, you old fool, you know. But, you know, they had nothing for me, because I'm not like these people. I'm not stupid, I'm not dumb, and So I went to psychoanalysis, and then as the years went by, I'd get jobs. But I drank a lot. And employers were always after me to do something about it. So AA was very new then. You could say, I'm going to this new thing called AA, Mr. Collins. I think that's going to work. Wonderful. And at least they give you 2 weeks to look for a new job, you know. And you go home and talk to your wife and say, I've gone back to AA, Charlotte. Wonderful. Maybe it'll help you this time. It's helping other people. I know that. I hear about that. What do they want you to do? Well, they want me to taper off. And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Ever since the birth of Al-Anon, there's never been any rest for anybody anywhere. We have the same stuff she did. We know it's about... Oh, shut up. When I went to psychoanalysis, I read books. I had ups and downs and ups and downs and ups and downs. I was a pretty good writer. I could go to a new city. I had a resume and get going. And I went up. I went up. But I went down one time, and I didn't come back. I couldn't believe it. That was in Dallas. I was working for a big firm called Tracy Locke, which was the largest advertising agency in the South. We were working on these Elmer and Elsie ads. And I cost them a big account because I had screwed something up badly. And they called me in and let me go. And by this time, people were used to communicating with my wife. By that time, her name, generally speaking, was Poor Charlotte. And they had called up Poor Charlotte and said they were going to let me go. She should make some plans. And she said yes. And so when I got fired, went off a little drunk for a couple of days, she sold the furniture and took the kids and left. I don't know where she went. I don't know where the furniture went. I get home, and my pile of clothes in the living room. They repossessed my car at the company. I was being evicted from my house. Just in a week ago, I was a big shot. And here I'm standing in front of a house with some clothes. And I knew I had to get out of Texas because it was kind of hot at the state hospital. So I got a drive-away car. I don't know if you know what that is. When you want your car taken somewhere else, you give it to this company and they deliver it. How they deliver it, they find somebody they know, the driver's license, who wants to go there, and they drive it. I got a car for Los Angeles. I don't know why Los Angeles. I'd never been there. I had to got out of Texas, got to Dallas, got to El Paso the next night, got drunk in Juarez. I used to live under the college faculty there at El Paso. Next night I got to Phoenix. Great, got drunk and lost the damn car. I parked it somewhere. It's still there, I guess. I never found it. I've gone back to look for it. All my clothes, everything I had, all I had on left was a suit, sweaty suit I had on. And I got in a beef in the street corner. Some guy was trying to be a cop, and he threw me in jail overnight. I'm going to cool you off, boy, which was a lie. It was about 115 in that jail. In the middle of the night, I was so sick, and I got up to him. I had to puke, and I went to the washroom and puked. He said, I misjudged. It wasn't the washroom. It was a guy's bunk is what it was. But he wasn't in it. But I mean, I vomited, and that made me feel better. I laid down next to it, put my head on the cool tile on the floor, and I felt better. Went to sleep, and he came back wherever he'd been. I guess he was a trustee or something. Found him drunk, laying next to his bed, and his bed full of vomit, and he could start kicking me. You damn drunken bastard! And kicked all my front teeth out. That was one of the few mornings I was ever glad I'd been in psychoanalysis, because I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. But I didn't want to say anything and make trouble. The next morning I hit the street and I was sick and covered with vomit and my mouth was bleeding. And I'd been going to AA off and on around the country for 10 years by this time. And every time I went to AA, I'd go there for a while. Until the heat was off, I'd give some newcomer a 10 or a 5. Here, kid, take care of yourself. A lot of time for me to make a little withdrawal here. So I found the Arid Club, part of that was, and walked over there in the hot sun and sat there and I smelled so bad. Nobody even talked to me. Finally, one old lady came over and said, are you sick, young man? Oh, yes, I am, man. I want to go to a 12-step hospital. They need $20, and I don't have $20. She said, I'll give you that. I grabbed that, ran downtown, got a bus ticket to Los Angeles, got out of there. I got to Los Angeles, where I knew one man, a man named, who was a big star at one of the radio stations there. And I'd given him his start. And I called him up. I said, I've had a terrible car accident. I got my teeth knocked out, lost my clothes. Can you give me a hand? He said, sure. He told me how to get a bus out to Hollywood, to KFWB. And he said, oh, God, you look terrible. He gave me $100 and some, which was a big lot of money in those days. I kind of drank for a few days, had a good time, and stopped. One night I was drunk, and the guy picked me up in Hollywood, took me to the AA Club. He said, here's the AA Club. You ought to go in there. And I went in there. Same old idiots. I gave them a little lecture on their stupidity and left and ran out of money a couple of days later. I called up my friend again. You know, my check hasn't come yet, and I don't know what I'm going to do. Can I even have some more money? He said, I called Dallas. You haven't got a check coming. You're a bum. Everybody knows you're a bum. Don't bother me at the station anymore. But Jesus, Ted. It was Ted Cullen. I got to have some money, really. I'm so sick. He's okay. Come to the back of this station tonight at 9 o'clock. There's an alley back of Hollywood Boulevard. He says, I'll come out in the fire escape, but you don't come to the station. Don't come back again. And it was raining, and I went over out there. He came out there finally, and he threw me a $5 bill and says, get your ass out of here. And it fluttered down to a mud puddle, and I crawled out and got it, which to this moment is as bad as I've ever come to hitting the bottom. And 2 days later, I found myself being thrown out of this Skid Row mission. And I just couldn't imagine what could be happening to me. I just couldn't imagine what could be happening to me. I mean, there wasn't anybody I could call anymore. Nobody seemed to care. I thought I was going to die there. But I knew how to go. I remember vaguely, I was in that AA club. And I was on the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax, wherever the hell that is. I said to somebody, where's Wilshire and Fairfax? I said, wow, Wilshire doesn't come all the way down here. You have to go up this hill to Hill Street and then cut over to Wilshire. It's a few ways. And walk west till you find it. It's a long way. I said, geez, I got to do something. I walked up this hill to Hill Street, over left to Wilshire, and walked west, and walked, and walked, and I still can remember it vaguely, and my mouth sore and bleeding, and it was raining, and cold, and sick, and my coat covered with vomit, and my shirt torn, and I counted later in my car, that was 72 long blocks. That's a long way to walk when you're sick and desperate. A woman asked me in New York one time, how could you possibly walk so far when you were sick and desperate? Of course, the answer is quite simple. That is the only time you can. If you had any alternative whatsoever, you would take it. But I got to this club, and I walked in, and they remembered me, and they weren't glad to see me. And I wasn't glad to see them. It's just hideous. I just and I lurked out of sight that night. They had a meeting, and I had about 4 pounds of cake. That's one thing I could eat with these teeth. And They had a meeting on gratitude. I almost puked it up again. Jesus. Everybody went home. It's still raining. I went to the club manager who still closed up. I said, I'm a newcomer, and I've had a terrible time. And I want sobriety on an all-time basis, but I have no place to sleep, and it's raining. Can you help me? I said, sure, kid. You're in luck. A guy named Joe Quaylift's an old 49 Merc in the parking lot. Last summer, still there. Tall grass doesn't run but a straw. You can sleep in that.
You want me to sleep in an abandoned car?
Yeah, good deal, huh?
Yeah, really. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
And I slept in that old abandoned car that night, and it was cold and rainy, and I was hungry and sick. And got up in the morning, came to this club, and it was Sunday morning now. We're having a spiritual meeting. When you're a sinner, a Lutheran, you don't want to hear spiritual meetings, I'll tell you. And I ate about 4 pounds of cake, and they talked about Jesus or God or somebody who was after me. And I got out of there, and I hid it all afternoon. The night there was another meeting. I went to that date cake and tried to shut off my ears. And slept in that abandoned car that night, came in the club, slept raining the next morning. This went on for days, just rain and cold and sick and meetings. And I remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. Maybe this is what hell is. It really isn't. This isn't fire. It's just being cold and sick and hungry, and everybody tells you about AA again and again. And I had no idea then or thereafter that would be my sobriety date, because I didn't want it to be. I didn't want to be sober. I had no. I've stayed sober for good reasons. I've stayed sober. You know, some of these new guys, you might think, well, Christ, if you really want to stay sober, I want to stay sober sometimes. One night I was in jail, years before that. And they had to come in the morning and say, well, you're all drunk last night. Your little son died and we couldn't find you. And I, oh, jeez, I almost went crazy. And I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy. And he's the apple of my eye. And I felt so bad. Remember that weekend, like just a couple months ago? I remember sitting in the living room with my father-in-law and my two brothers-in-law. And they were so kind to me. They'd give me coffee. Clancy, here, I want a Coke, a little cup of it. Always kindness. But in their eyes, you could say, you could just see, you dirty bastard, what are you doing to our sister? What are you doing to our sister, you dirty bastard? Wants more coffee, Clancy. I remember that very much. The next day, my son was buried, and when nobody's looking, I put my hand in his casket. I said, John Imslin, this will never happen again. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. It will never happen again. And I went back to work in Texas where I was working, and it's a strange feeling. I had almost a feeling of almost kind of exaltation, like you'd find at Easter or something. I felt so bad my son had died, but he didn't die in vain. He died so that I would save my life and I could save my family. And I said, he gave his life for us. And I just felt exalted. And I stayed sober. But then something happened to me that happened every time I stayed sober. Just took a little longer this time. One night, somebody snuck into my bedroom in the middle and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next morning, they start tightening it. And then starts coming back again. The irritability and the resentment and the feeling of restlessness and the people, sick of people screwing me around and on and on. And now, this time, I had addition to it by self-pity for my little boy. Sure, I had one little boy. That shitty God killed him and just to punish me. And the job I liked, I didn't like anymore. And the people were dumb and didn't like Texas. And my daughters, who I was doing it for, they made me crazy. They were all home this week. They gave me a surprise party on Tuesday for my birthday. I was thinking about that. But they were just little girls. And I said, Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. For Christ's sake, give me some quiet. And then hate myself for saying, I'm sorry, we'll play tomorrow. I just, all I needed was 2 or 3 drinks. If I could just ease off. But when you've taken them out of your son's casket, one day my wife took the kids to church. And I got to a point where I pulled my car in the garage and hooked up a hose in the exhaust pipe, and turned the motor and went to sleep. I just didn't know what to do. I was just crazed. And a neighbor happened to be watching out the window drinking coffee. Notice I didn't come out. Heard the motor running, walked over there and found me dead in the car. And pulled me out and they breathed my off, beat my chest. They rushed me to the hospital. Determined I was seriously mentally ill and committed me to the state insane asylum. Now that's how I get when I stop drinking, folks. That is not an alcohol problem. That is something wrong inside of me. And I always knew it. Because I'm not really an alcoholic. I drink, but it's not for... I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a feeler. I don't know how to explain that. And it just makes me crazy. Now, why would I stay sober this time when it was just uncomfortable and hate every moment of it? Once a year in January, I go up to Toronto to the North York Group, where they have, now prepare yourself for the exciting description here, a day with Clancy I. And up at the, I mean, it sounds romantic, except do you stop and think, in January in Toronto, you know, all the good speakers are speaking in Florida and Texas. But in the morning, they have a local speaker that I talk on, like, history of AA or the traditions or something like that. And then we have lunch, and then there's, in the afternoon, there's a question and answer meeting where the big visiting celebrity answers questions from the little people. Then there's a local speaker, and then there's a dinner, and then I have given an AA talk. And I, over the years, I've come to really like that question and answer meeting. I didn't know. I seem to have a flair I didn't know I had. Some of the questions are pretty good, and I don't know the answer right away. But I seem to have a flair to weave a verbal tapestry of BS while I think of the answer. A few years ago, I just given a wonderful answer, and a woman in the back said, "I have a question, please, Clancy." I said, "Yes, ma'am." She said, "If you don't mind, I wouldn't like one of your long answers." I thought somebody ought to slap that bitch. But I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy. I said, "Yes, ma'am." She says, "Every year you come up here and talk, tell us how long you slept. You're just hideous. Everything you touch turned to hell. It's just rotten. You're dying on the street. And now you've been sober forever, and everything you touch turns to gold. It's just wonderful. What in the world happened? What made the change? Just a sentence or two. Tell me what made the change." I said, "Well, ma'am, there's no way you can say that in a sentence or two. That's quite a complicated proposition. Series of things." And I thought to myself, if you come up here, though, I'll snatch you bald, you old bag. You know. Well, anyway, she threw off my timing. It ruined the whole afternoon for me. But that night I was taking a shower before I spoke, and the answer came, an answer I could have given her. I probably wouldn't have taken it. It was such a crappy little answer, but it was an answer. You know, I like answers that have a little body, a little panache, a little... We have some new people here tonight. I wish they'd leave here saying things like, "Did you hear what Clancy said?" "Wet birds don't fly at night." "Did you hear what Clancy said?" "Never mind if the horse is blind. Keep loading the wagon." Now, these answers mean nothing, but they give the newcomer hope. The answer I thought of, it was such a crappy little answer, and I want to say clearly, here was the correct answer. This was the first time in all the years I've been going to AA that I ever felt so bad that I let them make me take demeaning, terrible, embarrassing, stupid actions. I'm not talking about steps. I'm talking about worse than that. I had to go to these meetings all the time because the guy told me, if you don't go to the meetings, you can't hang around the club. You can't, you know. So I was there. And for example, in those days, they hadn't invented styrofoam cups yet. So every meeting had a porcelain cup. And after the meeting, somebody had to wash them. And the old timers got sick of washing them. You know, they're always looking for some new stooge to do it. And the guy said, "You there, boy without the front teeth. You want to wash dishes tonight?" If I had any strength left or integrity, I'd have said, "No. I don't want to wash dishes tonight or tomorrow night or any other night. Why didn't you lick them off with that long, ugly tongue of yours?" But if I did that, I was out in the rain, so I found myself saying, Another night, a guy said, "We need someone to help stay late and mop. How about you, kid? Can you do that?" Oh, I just felt so humiliated. Just the worst of all. I was living as a bandit. One night, a guy said, "We need some guys to come tomorrow night and set up. Jimmy won't be here. How about you, kid? You live right here on the property.
Son of a bitch.
It just got so bad. I remember thinking, oh, maybe that's why I thought I was dead. Maybe I'm in hell. I just go through every day. And then finally, a couple guys would buy me a hamburger that I could bite into. And I stayed sober 2 weeks. And honest, terrible. And that club was so, it was full of fanatics. It was a fanatic club. I hope never you fall into a club like that. But you stay sober for a couple of weeks. And no matter what your story is, they're on you like a pack of wild dogs, you know. Got a sponsor? Time to get a sponsor. Better get a sponsor, because you need a sponsor. I'd had sponsors. Now, I want to tell you new people here, I want to give you the facts. You'll meet people who want to be your sponsor, and they'll say, I want to help you through the steps with the book. But sooner or later, they all want to stick their nose in your business. And I'd had sponsors, and I used to see this actor coming in and out of the club. I'd seen him in movies. I'd been sober a little while, and he was coming out of meetings, and I'd seen him in movies. He was a character actor named Bob Bailey. He's dead now, but dead for a long time. But in the movies I saw him, he gave people money and helped them. And I thought, that's my new sponsor. I'm going to get some money from that simpleton. I'll get some teeth. I'll get some clothes. I've been sober for a while now. I'll go back to New York, get a job, tell them I've been sober, get some influence, and I'll save my money. And I'll come back to Los Angeles someday, and maybe I can buy this club, and I'll burn this goddamn thing down. And I hope they're all in it. It wasn't until years later I saw the movie Carrie, and I thought, yeah, that's what I meant. Burn them! Burn them! I said, Bob, will you be my sponsor? He said, sure I will, but you got to do what I say. Oh, sure, Bob. I've often thought about that. That guy should have won the Academy Award for every loving role he ever played, because they were totally foreign to his basic nature. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig. Just a terrible man. I want you to do this. Don't do that. Don't do that. I felt like Quasimodo. 4 weeks ago tonight, I was speaking in Paris. And Saturday afternoon, I went over to Notre Dame. And I went inside and I thought, I heard Duck Bob was probably up there who wants me to ring the bell, for Christ's sake. And I've thought many times, why would I take that crap from that guy? Because at that stage of my life, I didn't take crap from anybody, and I hadn't for some time. I mean, even when I was still working, I've left jobs that people would die for because somebody gave me too much crap. Give me that crap, get yourself another boy, pal. And I know how many nights in bars people come over and say, I would listen to you mouth off all night. You don't hear very much to me. You don't think so, son of a bitch? Why don't you try me, see how I am? And I get knocked on my can a lot. But they know I'm half crazy and half tough, which isn't a bad reputation to have in a bar. I thought, why would I take that? You know, I was sober almost a year before I ever heard a guy talk about that phenomenon of not taking crap from people. And I've never heard it talked about since. It's amazing. I'm sure somebody talked about it, but it can't be that unique. But I heard a guy, I thought, that's it. And something, what he explained was the same thing I could explain. In those years as they went along, it became more and more clear to me that inside I was a weakling. And I hate weaklings. I hate myself as a weakling. I want to be a macho man. I'm a weakling. Other men are men. And I got fear and doubt. And I got whine. Do they like me? And the defense against this, you don't show it to anybody. Anybody gives you any crap, you just don't take that crap, because otherwise they'll know you're weak. And it's caught. And one of the bad things about it, when you go to AA even, you can't take any advice here, meaningful, because they'll know you're weak and laugh at you. So you, thanks, pal, but that doesn't quite fit my case. See you around. Now, why would I take crap from this guy? And somebody gave me a tape from God I made in 1965, or they made it of me in 1965. And I was talking about that, and I haven't thought about this for 30 years till recently. And it's because of this. Now, he didn't like me. It turned out he didn't like me very well, because I was a smart aleck. My defense was a smart mouth. And when you have a smart-mouthed loser, especially without teeth and old clothes, they really just, oh, shut up, you know. But he didn't like, but he tried to help me. And a couple of times he took me to hear him talk, and he'd talk to me sometimes at the club. And I think what it boiled down to was this, as far as I could tell. Somewhere along the line, I heard him talking about how his adult life he'd spent feeling different and feeling not quite enough and feeling that he didn't get along with people very well and there was something missing in him. And he discovered a few drinks solved that and it helped him a lot. But then sometimes he drank too much and people thought he had a drinking problem. But that really wasn't it at all. He had much deeper emotional problems. I remember thinking, my God, that's the first time I ever heard my story. That's me. And I thought, and yet he's getting along well and staying sober in AA. What the hell is he doing? How is he doing it? And what it did, it brought about a begrudging respect for him. Because he wasn't as I thought he was. Which resulted in, when he would tell me to do things, mostly I would do them. And I didn't because I thought it worked. I didn't think AA was worth the crap. But I wanted him to like me. And here's the interesting fact, new people. The actions of AA don't care why you take them. As long as you take them. And I gradually started to get better. I didn't do very well. I mean, he was tough on me. I said, Bob, I've been sober 3 weeks. I'm living in an abandoned car. I got old, dirty clothes on. People laugh at me and ridicule me. I don't blame him. You know, I'm an intelligent, sensitive person. I got no teeth. They're just dreadful. What could I do, Bob? He said, get a job. I said, get a job? Look how terrible I look. He said, get a terrible job. I followed that direction, I'll tell you. I was a busboy and a dishwasher and a pick and shovel guy for 2 days till I couldn't get the pick on the ground. They let me go. But I stayed sober somehow. And little by little, over a period of time, I stayed sober and did through serious funny things. I did some of the steps when I was in such pain. Got little jobs. Lost them a lot. By the time I was a year sober, I got a little job in the back of an advertising agency, wrapping packages in that little one-room apartment in Hollywood. I just barely made the rent on. But I kept going to meetings every night. And until I was 2 years sober, I finally got a job as a beginning writer in a medical corporation. I'd been a top writer. Now I was a beginning writer. And I'd stashed the money. My sponsor had me send money home to my kids. I didn't mind doing that. But I stashed it little by little so I could get some front teeth. And I got this job, this medical corporation. I said, Bob, I got some money. I want to get some front teeth. I'm going to really crack about this job. You got some money? Send that to your kids in Dallas. I said, Jesus, Bob. They all got front teeth. He said, they got a shitty father, too. Send them the money. So I went to work at this corporation. I learned to carry my lip like this. Nobody knew I didn't have front teeth. I thought I'd been burned in a fire, I guess. But I went to work every day. He was insistent on me going to work every day. He's crazy, fanatic. Go to work every day. And I'd have problems. I didn't get along well with people. I'd call him with these problems, and he'd tell me answers. And I look at those first couple of years of that company, and I learned some of the great spiritual lessons that have helped me more. I maybe should have learned them when I was 10 years old, but I didn't learn them till then. And I'll tell you some great, if you're new to that, let me tell you some great spiritual, what are the spiritual lessons of AA? Prayer and meditation. That's right. But let me give you some others you wouldn't ordinarily think about. Do what you said you would do. Be where you said you would be when you said you would be there. Don't take out your hostilities on people who can't answer back. Children, employees, waiters and waitresses. On days you know you're having a bad day, watch that mouth because you can cut relationships right in half and never know what the hell happened. Then you had some crappy ones too. Like if you're pushing your cart through a store and you see some box or can on the floor, somebody left there, stop and pick it up. That's what you're for. He gave me some more like that. He gave me one that... I tried it a couple days ago again. It just made me crazy. But let somebody make an illegal front left turn in front of you. Jesus. But little by little, I went to work, and eventually I got front teeth that I saved up for. And I was 5 years sober as director of advertising for that corporation. And I had front teeth now, and I smiled a lot. I was 7 years sober. Another guy and I were brought into Hollywood, and we created something called Boss Radio, became the number one hard rock station in the world. We said things like, "What's coming on down, baby?" When I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations for an oil company. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Dallas, leaped out of their post office box, rushed to my side, attached themselves to me like a group of starving chiggers. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. Thank God somebody gave me a metronome and the rhythm system, and that ended all that crap, you know. The rhythm system isn't much, but it sure beats coitus interruptus. And now my kids are all grown up. Three of my daughters are turning 13 this year in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the others are not alcoholic. They're doing all right. That last child is a son, so I had a son again. He's grown up. He's 37 years old, very successful. Only one of my kids has turned out bad. She was home, as I say, Tuesday for my birthday. I sometimes get tears in my eyes when I see her. She's become a judge. I had so hoped for a public defender, but no. When she was home at Christmas a couple years ago, she said, "Dad, when we were little girls, you used to send us to our room." I said, "Sure, honey." She said, "When you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room." I got nothing I left in Albuquerque. But isn't that nice? I now live in a nice home out by the ocean, and that's where the wind blows. It's cool and it's cloudy in the mornings, but sunny in the afternoon. Never gets hot like you have it here. Everything is fine. And to you new people here tonight, I want you to know that there's a new young man sitting over here somewhere. Where was he in the first 30 days? Is it one of some of the first 30 days here? You. I'm going to tell you something that I know is going to make you feel a bit better tonight. I've got it all together, and you haven't. But I know you're happy for me, and that's what counts. That sounds terrible. I don't mean it badly. I just want to know where you work, because I want to tell you something. I want to talk to you for 4 minutes, and I'm going to get out of here. This is all an involved introduction to a short talk. You and the other people here might go home tonight thinking, "That guy got upset. He's an alcoholic. When did he become an alcoholic? Was an alcoholic when he drank? Was an alcoholic when he got sober? Was an alcoholic after he got sober? Now, how did he become an alcoholic?" And that always was a great problem, because my problem really isn't alcohol. It is, but it isn't. I don't know how to explain that. The book describes it, grave emotional problems. I know about them, and I hide them. Now, how could I be an alcoholic? And I think it goes back to what I was about. Wasn't a few months sober. I was going through kind of a bad session. I'd been out of that abandoned car living with a guy on his sofa. And then his wife made me leave because I accidentally put out some cigarettes in the rug. Well, the ashtray was out of reach. And then I went back to that car for a little while. Then I went to somebody else's. And I stayed with this guy, Jim McCann, until one night his girlfriend came over at 3 in the morning for some friendship. And he woke me up and said, "Do you mind hitting the streets just for a couple hours?" I said, "Why don't you have her hit the streets? She's more used to it than I am." Back in the abandoned car that night. But this was now, I was back in the abandoned car. I was on like on Wednesday, and I had a new job coming up Friday, and I was feeling pretty good, and I had a couple bucks in my pocket. Even though I was in the abandoned car for a couple of nights, I didn't mind that. Got kind of a joke. And I went to the noon meeting in the club. And I like noon meetings because that's where you find philosophers. There's no work, talk about work and jobs and all that shit. We talk about deep meanings and the under, you know, just wonderful.
And they all try to get a ride home somehow.
But they were talking on the first step, as I recall. And I felt so good, I thought I'd be honest. I'd make an honest statement. I said, you know, I really envy you people. Because you can admit you're an alcoholic in the first step. And then, I know, because I've been around AA for many, many years, those steps really work for alcoholics if you're an alcoholic. But when you're not, I'm not really an alcoholic. I wish I were. I know I have grave emotional problems, but my problem is not really alcohol. And I don't know, maybe some of those steps fit me, maybe they don't. But I can't seem to make them work. I just can't get along. And I really envy you people. I really wish I were an alcoholic. And I thought about that later. Why I knew I was an alcoholic. Because I'd been going to AA off and on for years. And I didn't learn much. I learned what an alcoholic was. If you go to this meeting every month from now on, at least 12 times this year, you'll hear 12 speakers get up here. And they all have different stories and backgrounds and experiences. But the one thing that the thread through all of them will be this. Either overtly or implicitly, or they will do it subconsciously. But they'll say, I used to drink and my life was terrible. I came to AA and got sober, and now I'm feeling better. And I could go for part of that. I could go drinking stories with anybody. I always like to talk drinking stories in AA. Because I've been in jail a lot. No big deals, but overnight. Because I have a tendency to counsel police officers. And I go to jail at night. And I've been in state hospitals and nut houses and had shock treatments. And I've been in AA in a lot of places. You want to talk about AA in New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Dallas, El Paso, Milwaukee. Anyway, I can talk AA. Talk about regional differences. But the one difference is this that I can't overcome. Unlike alcoholics, is when I get sober and clean up my act, that's when my life gets painful. And the longer I stay sober, the worse it gets. And I watch the people around me get better, and I'm getting worse. I don't know what it is. There's something wrong with me. Now, how can I be an alcoholic? And I gave what I thought was an honest statement. And about 10 seconds after the meeting, the snitches got to Bob again, you know. Here's what he said today, Bob. And for the next few days, Bob and another guy gave me a little seminar. And I'll condense it into just 3 or 4 minutes. But it went something like this. Well, you can't admit you're an alcoholic in the first step. Is that right? That's right, Bob. I told you that. I'm not fooling. I wish I could, but I can't. He said, well, where in the first step does it say you're an alcoholic? Well, it doesn't actually say so. But that's what it means, and you know it, and I know it. He says, why don't you just try reading the black parts on the page for a while? It says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Do you think you're powerless over alcohol? Not really. He says, what do you think powerless is? I said, Jesus, you hear these guys talking meetings, they get drunk and rape nuns and fly to Hong Kong and hold up banks. And I'm just a good guy that's been screwed around a lot, Bob. Because I don't think that's what it means. It means that there's a certain small group of drinkers and all big groups of drinkers, maybe 8 or 9% of drinkers, get an unnatural effect from alcohol. What do you think that unnatural effect is, kid? I said, I guess they stay drunk all the time, do crazy things. He said, no, that isn't it at all. This is podium talk. The unnatural effect is something entirely different. Alcohol must do something special for you that it doesn't do for most people. A few drinks of alcohol must have the ability to almost instantly change your perception of reality. I guess that's right, Bob. He said, it doesn't mean that every time you drink you run amok. You can have 4 or 5 drinks and go home and go to bed. You can have 4 or 5 drinks and go to Mexico. You can have 4 or 5 drinks, fall in love with an 89-year-old woman on a walker. You know, something's going to happen, that's all. That didn't happen every time with me. He says, it doesn't happen every time. The problem is you never know how it's going to turn out. Every time you drink, you start playing Russian roulette. And when you're young, you win a lot of games. Well, I outlasted that till 5 in the morning. Just got home in time, take a shower, take a shave, went to work. Click. Boy, that broad last night.
whiskey turned me every way but loose. I had to go out of a washroom window in a bar to get away from that bang. Jesus, I got home in time. Click. But every so often, you hit a loaded chamber. Jeez, I went to that lefty's bar. I said, what a dive that is. I got in a fight with the guy, broke my glasses, went to jail overnight, got out this morning. Christ, never go to that bar again. Boom. You know. But he says, as you get older, some sinister, unfortunate force puts more and more shells in that baby. And you wind up like you, kid. Boom. Jesus. Boom. Jesus. Boom. Jesus. There's a click in here somewhere. Boom. All you got to admit is that you don't know what's going to happen if you start drinking. That is powerless over alcohol. I guess that's right, Bob, but that isn't why my life is unmanageable. It says that we're powerless over alcohol, therefore our lives are unmanageable. But that isn't why my life is unmanageable. The pain comes when I'm sober. He says, it doesn't say that. He says, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, dash. In the English language, dash means end of thought, beginning of new thought. Maybe that's what's happened to your writing career. He says, it also says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Do you think you're powerless over alcohol? He says, our lives have become unmanageable. Do you think your life's unmanageable?
Not really.
He says, what do you think is unmanageable? I said, well, all these crazy things and all these things. That isn't me, Bob. I don't know how to explain that, but my life is bad when I'm sober. That's what's the problem. He said, look, kid, I'll tell you something. Out in Malibu, the richest man in America sits at AA meetings 4 or 5 nights a week. And he could afford to buy treatment centers, chains of psychologists, any psychiatrist in the world. He could have anybody. And he sits at AA meetings. Why do you think he does that?
I don't know, Bob.
He says because he's an alcoholic, and he says that helps him more than all the therapies he's had. I said, Jesus, that's something, Bob. He said, I'm going to tell you something, kid. We all get born, go through problems and cares and problems and frustrations and all pain. And some of us are lucky enough to discover as we go along that a few drinks gets rid of the pain. Gets rid of the problem. Puts it aside for a while. Then he gets sober again, and then you keep going, get some more problems, put them aside. You keep putting them aside. But if drinking's doing this for you, eventually you're going to get to a point where you got to stop drinking. Tell me to stop drinking. And all of a sudden, after a while, you realize all of this crap is starting to surface again. Your frustrations, your childishness. He says it's a sad thing, kid. But for alcoholics, it's almost as though we have grown-up bodies and grown-up brains and grown-up strength and grown-up abilities, all at the intermittent beck and call of childish emotions. She's like, that's right, Bob. He said, you get to a point where you can't stand to stay sober. Eventually you have to drink to stand it. But you can't keep drinking, you've got to get sober. But you realize alcohol is not really my problem. They don't understand. But eventually you're going to have to drink. You go back and forth. He said, the only right thing you've said today, kid, he said, your problem isn't alcohol. You're right, it isn't. I said, it isn't. He said, your problem is something that sounds like alcohol and will kill you if you don't do something about it, but it isn't alcohol. It is something called alcoholism. I said, well, Jesus, Bob, that's the same thing, alcoholism. He says, not at all. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. In this hideous thing called alcoholism, which looks the same to the naked eye, this dreadful thing, eventually you'll stop drinking and clean up your act, but it has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to make it gradually so painful you can't stand it. And eventually you must drink. And then you must get sober. And you must do that till you die. Always knowing I'm not really an alcoholic because my problem really wasn't alcohol. I said, Jesus, Pop, that's me. He said, there's a name for people like you. I said, what is it, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. And I said, well, I'll be damned. So I'll tell you something. I had just spent 10 bad years going from something to a bum on the street because I could not find a definition of alcoholic that seemed to fit me. And there it was right there. I couldn't believe it. And I think what I did that day without being aware of it, I didn't even know about chapter 3, read that sometime later, but what I did that day without being aware of it, I believed I was an alcoholic. And so I did something I had never been able to do. I conceded to my inner soul, most self, that I was an alcoholic. And the result of that was this. I never again, and that was in January or so of 1959, I never again had a severe, strong desire for a drink of alcohol. Now, you might think, well, it's just wonderful for him. Isn't that great? His life has been wonderful. Not at all. I had some bad days in my early sobriety. You know, like all days. But a couple times in my early sobriety, I came close to committing suicide. I felt so bad. But I wasn't going to do it by drinking. And when my family came back, it sounded so wonderful to everybody. But I'd been living alone in Hollywood in a little apartment, and I finally got the pace to go, and all of a sudden had to change kids and wife talking and dogs and cats and pressures. I mean, and I really felt myself just getting so tight after a while. And one day after work, I jumped in my car and I ran away. I got as far as India, way out by Arizona. I suddenly thought, I can't do this. God damn it, that's not what AA's about. I called my sponsor. He said, come on down, talk to me. And I went down and talked to him. And we talked till 5 in the morning. And I went home and took a shower and went to work and did it again. I mean, little by little, squeezed through. Well, I lost my job as a dishwasher when I was 6 months sober and almost committed suicide. You can't hold a job as a dishwasher. But my sponsor used that pain to get me to write an inventory. Because one of the great things about admitting I was an alcoholic is I knew I would have to take those steps. My defenses went down on them. I did them all. Made amends to my father, a man I hadn't talked to in 10 years. There are a lot of things. But they all changed my life. And probably the last thing, if you want to talk about a little revenge, doesn't look like revenge, but it is. When I was 15 years sober in some hideous fit of do-gooderism, I left a job as a marketing director at a big publishing firm, and for the last 28 years, I've been the managing director of the Skid Row Mission that threw me out in 1958. And I'm still looking for those two guys. Some guy said to me one day, why would you give up your very highly paid career to run that mission? And I'd never be able to think of a good answer to that. Well, there was such a significant decrease in salary, I thought it was spiritual. But yesterday morning, I had experience, none of you had, I'm sure. I go to work in the morning, get out of my car, step over the bodies of dying men and women to get to my office. I go home at night and I step over the bodies of men and women dying from alcoholism and drug addiction on the sidewalk, get in my car and go home. And I used to die that same Saturday. Why don't you help these people? I've tried to help those people a lot. Those are the people we can help. But you know the difference between those people and me or you? It's hard to remember. Now, you can give socioeconomic reasons and psychological profiles, all sorts of things. But it boils down to this at the bottom, and I'm dead serious. The main difference between them and me, they are unwilling to take actions they disagree with. That is, when they start to do that, they start to get better. But they won't do it. If they start to do it, they won't do it very long. That thing is corny and crappy. So they're going to die in that damn sidewalk. But there are some people inside who are. We are helping. It's not a treatment center anyway. It's a Skid Row mission. And it really has been a very good thing for me. The last thing I want to say is I'm a very strong believer in action. Action is what does it here. Getting involved, doing the things, trying to be of service to others. And even to this day, I've been sober forever and things are going good. But even to this day, for example, when I was about 5 years sober, I wanted to be secretary of a meeting. I thought, I've got front teeth now, I could really be a good secretary. And the biggest meeting in Los Angeles was the Brentwood meeting. And I had a stooge on their steering committee. And I said, mention my name at your meeting and nominate me for secretary. I said, I'm ready to go, baby. And I saw him the next day. I said, well, did I get elected? He said, no, your name died for lack of a second. I could see there was going to be an uphill battle there. But then the guy said, over in Ohio Street, there's a little meeting hall where they have meetings 7 nights a week. And the Tuesday night meeting just blew up. It's wide open. You know anybody who wants to rent the hall? I said, yes, I do. I got 9 tattered followers, and we rented it. I named something called the Pacific Group, and I wrote a little format, and that first night we had a speaker come in from outside and two local speakers, Ted Medicine speakers, and the next week we had about 16 people. And the next week we had about 20 people. Then I think I offended some people with my announcements because we were back to 9 again. But the end of a year, it had grown to about 40 regular members. And I thought to myself, you know, a lot of groups now would have an election. But that would really be unfair to these people because they're just groping for sobriety and I would leave them rudderless, you know. I'm going to sacrifice myself and just be secretary for another year. I'm not going to say a word. So I did. I sacrificed myself. At the end of 2 years, we were really good. We had about 65 people regularly. And I thought, God, they're like an emerging third world country. They're almost ready for self-government, but not quite. I'm going to sacrifice myself again. And about 2 months later, some guy came up in the kitchen where I was sitting. Said, are we ever going to have you? And I saved this man's life sometime before that. Are we ever going to have an election for secretary? I said, why? We're doing well. We're following the tradition. We're doing well. You don't like it? For Christ's sake, what's wrong? He said, no, don't get mad. He said, but all the people in the other meeting said this is a dictatorship. And if we had an election and voted for you, nobody could say a word. I said, good idea, Jimmy. So we had an election, and I was swept out of office. But to show you what a good foundation...